The following program is brought to you by Caltech.
Our next speaker is Dr. Eli Ivanovich, who's professor of electrical engineering and computer science at UC Berkeley, where he holds the James and Catherine Lau Chair in Engineering. He's also the director of the NSF Center for Energy Efficient Electronics Science, a multi-university center based at Berkeley. He's a fellow of IEEE, the Optical Society of America, and the American Physical Society. He's a life member of Eta Kappa Nu and a member of the National Academy of Engineering and the National Academy of Sciences. He's been awarded the Adolf Lahm Medal, the W. Streicher Scientific Achievement Award, the R. W. Wood Prize, the Julius Springer Prize, and the Mountbatten Medal. He also has an honorary PhD from the Royal Institute of Technology, Stockholm, Sweden. In his photovoltaic research, Ivanovich introduced the 4N² light trapping factor that is used commercially in almost all high-performance solar cells. Ivanovich introduced the idea that strained semiconductor lasers could have superior performance due to reduced valence band or hole effective mass, and today almost all semiconductor lasers use this concept, including telecommunication lasers, DVD players, and red laser pointers. Eli is regarded as one of the fathers of the photonic bandgap concept and coined the term photonic crystal. And today he's going to be telling us about the multispectral optoelectronic physics of solar cells for efficiencies greater than 30%.
Okay, it's a great pleasure to be here and to follow the previous speakers who have already explained so much that is very important. And what I'd like to do is perhaps talk about the next step about how we're going to keep increasing efficiencies. Now, we heard in the question period about balance of systems costs. And of course, it's very important to think about balance of systems costs. And as the panel cost comes down, which seems to be quite inevitable now, but we're seeing costs that are much lower than people expected. Well, if the panels go down in cost, the only way the different technologies can compete is through their efficiency. So we need to think about higher efficiencies. And just looking at the where things are right now, clearly 30% efficiency. I hate to say this, but it almost forms a baseline. Just to be in the game, you have to be able to talk about greater than 30% efficiency. So that is actually a very big change in photovoltaics. In fact, there was mentioned already the new record by Alta Devices for flat plate thin film cell. So this is the world record for single junction cells. And it's quite remarkable. And I guess the most remarkable thing about it is that nothing had changed for almost 20 years. And just in the past 2 or 3 years, the efficiency has gone up. And this tremendous improvement has involved some new physics, which I'll describe the new physics in a couple of slides. But the entire improvement is due to a boost in voltage. Now, voltage is one of the more subtle aspects of solar cells. People often talk about boosting the current, and to understand that, you have to be like a good accountant, keep track of where the current went. It's like money, you just watch the flows. Voltage is a little bit more subtle, and it requires a little bit of thought. I'll try to explain it as best I can, but it just shows that this entire improvement, breaking the record, going from 25 to close to 29% over the past 2 or 3 years in a single junction cell, that has come about because of the voltage boost. So where does voltage come from? Well, Harry Atwater explained to us about the Shockley-Queisser analysis, a brilliant thermodynamic analysis that told us what is the ideal open circuit voltage to expect. But implicit in this analysis, but not necessarily spelled out, is the idea that in order to achieve that very, very high theoretical voltage, you actually have to be in a very unusual physical situation. And that is that if you're at open circuit and the electrons and holes cannot go into the wires, where do they go? And ideally, they would go, just come back at you or just come back at the sun. And so it becomes very important that under ideal conditions, all of the sunlight can come back as luminescence. And that represented the ideal condition put forward by Shockley. But in practice, it's very difficult to get very high external fluorescence. And it's also very counterintuitive. How would you like it if I come and tell you that for your solar cell to perform well, you have to give back some of the light? And people have rebelled against this. They say, no, why should I be giving back any of the light? I'm trying to achieve the highest possible efficiency. Nonetheless, to get the highest voltage, you do have to give back some of the light. And at open circuit, you have to give back all of the light. So it's actually a very counterintuitive insight. But this is exactly what led to the new efficiency records that I just mentioned. So the landscape is roughly as follows. At least this was the situation 3 years ago, is that we were up at 25% efficiency and very close to that, but we were still quite far from the theoretical limit, which was 33.5. And we made up the difference with some new physics, some new ideas, which are illustrated on this slide. So this was the picture of a really good solar cell as it existed, let's say, 3 years ago. Is the light would come in, you would produce electron-hole pairs, the electron-hole pairs would go their separate ways, it'd be collected, and if you do that very well, you could get efficiencies of around 25%. And starting 2 or 3 years ago, a rather different picture emerged for what is the ideal solar cell. And that is, yes, you have your sunlight coming in, and it produces electron-hole pairs, but in a really good cell, those electron-hole pairs have a very high probability of recombining radiatively. No problem. They emit a luminescent photon. Now, that luminescent photon bounces around. It gets absorbed, re-emitted many, many times, and finally escapes. Now, according to Schalk and Quasar, the escape is actually good. Because the more luminescence efficiency you have externally, that's an indication of having very low internal losses, which enables you to achieve the theoretical limits. So in this new picture of solar cells, yes, you have one sun coming in, but you could easily have 30, 40, 50 suns of internal trapped luminescence. And that becomes the essential thing. And with that tremendous amount of trapped luminescence, you have a decent probability that at least some of those photons will get out. And it's a very different picture of what a solar cell should be. It should have one sun coming in, but it should have trapped internally 30, 40, even 50 suns of infrared luminescence. And the recognition of this enabled the new efficiency records. The idea that you're trapping light and recycling it internally, it forces you to have a really good mirror. So all the recent records are not based on changing the material of the solar cell or improving the material. They're based on just making the mirror better. And, you had a 96% reflectivity mirror, new record. You get a 97% reflectivity mirror, and you beat that record. You have another new record, 98. There's going to be another record as well. So all of these improvements are an indication of improving the mirror, and also you still do want to have the most outstanding material that has 99% or better internal fluorescence yield. So this has opened up the door to higher efficiencies than what people expected, and actually this little story is written up as a little news report in IEEE Photonic Society news this month, so you can go look that up. Now, one of the questions, though, is that how do you get the light out? And there are two aspects of this. And one aspect is that you have photon recycling, you know, and that's very good. But there's another way to get the light out, and that is by texturing the front surface. And then not only do you get the light out, but you have an equally important benefit that we've heard about, and that is of trapping the light. And so it leads to the question, what is the ideal surface texture in a thin film that will do the best job of absorbing light, and by reciprocity, therefore, it will do a great job of emitting light? Both are required for solar cells. And so it leads then to a search, a mathematical search, for the ideal surface texture on a thin film. Surprisingly, this question has never been answered before, is what is the best way to texture a thin film to absorb the greatest amount of light? Now, with some kind of luck, I can turn this on as an animation. So let's see if the animation works. And so here we're going through a series of mathematical iterations aiming toward the highest possible light trapping. And indeed, when you do this, there is surprisingly a spontaneous symmetry breaking that occurs. And this is somewhat non-intuitive. Let me run the video again one more time because I want to show where it ends up. First of all, it ends up with rather an asymmetric landing. I guess it's shown on the next slide. And what you're seeing here, oops, this is a little bit stronger than I was hoping for. Let's go to pen. And what you're seeing here is the optimal shape. You've broken the symmetry. In fact, in general, what we have found through this mathematical procedure, which we call inverse design, is that you do tend to break the symmetry. You end up with odd shapes. This is not the most odd shapes. It's actually even better when the shape is even more asymmetrical. And what is happening is that this mathematical optimization is forcing you into a type of photonic band structure. And this texture, you can imagine that texture being described by periodic boundary conditions, which are often used, in which case you'd say, well, you end up with a two-dimensional photonic crystal. But in fact, it's pushing you up into the very high-lying bands of the photonic crystal, where you have very random trajectories, random bands, and that in fact that is exactly what nature is telling you to do, and you end up with a very asymmetrical symmetry breaking, which gives you the strongest optical absorption. So that's a project that is being conducted by Vidya Ganapati, who is part of our center. Now, that's all well and good. I should mention the 28.8% record did not include the texturing. So when the texturing gets added, undoubtedly it'll be 29.8, which means we're effectively at 30%, and we need to get going above 30% now. So here is an example of a 30% or greater than 30% solar cell that could be made based upon the ALTA devices technologies, which is peeled and lifted off gallium arsenide films and with a second layer of indium gallium phosphide as an additional tandem cell, a monolithic tandem cell. There is very, very little cost in growing the added cell because you're growing the gallium arsenide cell anyway, so it's just as easy to add an indium gallium phosphide cell on top of that. Now, lattice matched, it should be possible to have a practical efficiency of around 34%. So that's getting us above the 30% that we talked about. And in fact, the latest results have come in from ALTA devices, and they're now at 30.8% and essentially in a very low-cost thin film technology, where the substrate is being reused. And just to show what it looks like, whoops, it is jumping ahead for no reason that I can figure. Let me go back. Okay, so you got a preview of all the upcoming slides. But this is a picture, not a picture, this is the actual cell itself, showing the flexibility and showing how adaptable it is. And so it goes along with some of the other ideas that you've heard, is that we're entering a stage of very high efficiency and very low cost, and it's taken a long time for the field to get to this point. So in splitting the solar spectrum, it's well known that if we can take slice and dice the solar spectrum and treat each part individually, we can do a much better job. And you saw the beginnings of that with the first tandem solar cell from ALTA devices. So we have some strategies. How shall we do this? And I showed you the tandem solar cell, which basically involved sunlight coming in and maybe some orange light coming in, or red light coming in and going into the gallium arsenide layer, into this layer. And we have some shorter wavelengths going into the gallium indium phosphide layer. And, there's some interesting effects that occur. You know, we've learned that for a very good solar cell, we have to have luminescence. So one of the interesting effects that occurs when you do this very well is the luminescent coupling between the layers. And that actually has many benefits. So that's one way of making a multi-junction solar cell. That is serial splitting. First, you strip off the green light, and then you strip off the red light, and so forth. Well, there's another approach possible, and that's lateral splitting. So you can imagine coming along the surface, and the solar spectrum would be subdivided into the different colors. Along this top surface, you'd have a diffractive optical element which would redirect the sunlight into different solar cells, each one of which is optimized for a different part of the solar spectrum. So this is serial splitting, this is lateral splitting. Both of them are very viable and have roles to play. Oops, it is jumping ahead again. Okay, let me do it this way. Okay, what are some of the issues that come up? Well, I showed you this slide before, but I also indicated to you that there was this voltage boost, which we'd like to have. And unfortunately, if you look at the structure, you do a very good job of recycling the infrared light that would be coming from here, because it would not get absorbed in the upper cell. But if you try to reflect and recycle the luminescence from the upper cell, unfortunately, it would just get absorbed in the lower cell. So the voltage boost only benefits the lower cell. And ideally, we would like to have it benefit all the different layers in a tandem cell. And the way to do that is somewhat challenging, in that you have to try to trap the luminescence, the high-energy luminescence in the upper cell, and at the same time, of course, it's quite easy to trap the low-energy luminescence in the lower cell, but you're trying to prevent the big luminescent photons from going into the lower cell. And the challenge is how to do that. Now, you could think that, well, that's an interesting challenge. You want each layer of the tandem to trap its own luminescence, and at the same time that it's trapping luminescence, it has to let the sunlight come straight through. Now, you could say, well, the luminescence is at a slight frequency shift compared to the incoming sunlight, so I can use some type of spectral filter. But the luminescence is really just too close to the band edge, to the incoming sunlight. And so it turns out that the best way to trap luminescence and not interfere with the sunlight is based on angular selectivity rather than spectral selectivity. And the angular selectivity comes about if you have an interlayer between the tandem layers of a very low index. Ideally, you'd like to have an index of 1. Maybe you'd make it out of air or aerogel, some low index material. And then you do a fantastic job of reflecting the internal luminescence, 98% reflectivity of the internal luminescence. At the same time, you want the sunlight to go through unperturbed by the strong reflection. And you do that because by including an anti-reflection coating. And this anti-reflection coating does not penalize the total internal reflection. It coexists with the total internal reflection. So you're trying to have an anti-reflection coating at the same time that you're having total internal reflection. And that is actually achievable. And you can actually get 99% transmission through the anti-reflection coating, and at the same time have 98% reflection of the luminescence that you'd like to trap. And the benefit of this, then, the 98% reflection and 99% transmission, is that you can extend the voltage boost that has allowed the new efficiency records, you can extend that to the upper layers of a tandem solar cell. So that is something that we may see in future tandem solar cells. Now, one would like to then also think about optimizing the top and bottom band gaps. And although the optimal bottom band gap tends to be around 1 volt, that's only if you imagine ideal conditions at 25 centigrade. If you allow the panel to get warm, it pushes you to a slightly higher band gap. And in fact, I've been pushing for band gaps around 2 electron volts, where you could, in a structure where no current matching is required, you could think about perhaps approaching 40% efficiency. So the question is how to do that. So I'd like to describe what's involved in using lateral splitting. So there are some issues. You say, well, you have the sunlight coming in on top, and you're going to subdivide it into a red cell, a yellow cell, and a green cell. Sounds very easy, but there's a little problem you have to be very careful of. And that is the sunlight is occupying the full area of the front panel. But by the time it gets to the rear area, it occupies a smaller area. And that smaller area is inevitable in this type of configuration. So you have concentrated the sunlight from big area to a somewhat smaller area. Now, any kind of concentration has to come at some kind of penalty. You've got to put some effort into concentration, because concentration ends up as free energy. And so in this case, you overcome this problem by recognizing that you're going to be making this panel out of glass, and the refractiveness of glass gives you enough focusing power. So if the rays are coming in from these angles and these angles, nonetheless, they will focus down properly to a smaller area just due to the refractive index change. And that becomes a very important part of understanding lateral splitting. I don't know any other way of doing lateral splitting other than by having a refractive index of this sort, which allows a separate concentration of the different colors onto the different solar cells on the back. And we heard from John Rogers how the technology for pick and place manipulation of small area solar cells, that this has become more commonplace. And in fact, that type of technology is exactly what would be used for lateral splitting. Although it doesn't have to be that small. One can imagine these stripes would actually be a millimeter wide. So the cells are not that small. We have to consider how we go from the big area on the front to the separate solar cells on the back. Now, you say, oh, fine, you can probably do that, but what's this holographically patterned surface that's going to redirect the different colors where they need to go? And that is a very difficult mathematical problem. How do you come up with a design for the hologram? So I'd like to show you a little bit about the mathematics that allows for these types of designs. And it has a very evocative name. It is officially called shape calculus, and it tells us how to make the shape of different types of structures for us, where we'd like to have some kind of a holographic texturing which would separate the colors. Now, I won't get too much into the math, but it is pretty fancy, advanced applied mathematics. Uses the adjoint conjugate gradient method, which is an optimization method. It's a very beautiful method in that with two electromagnetic simulations, you get the derivative of the merit function at all points in space, so it's fantastic. You get a shape derivative, which tells you how to change the shape on the next iteration. So you might say, oh, man, no one's ever done this. A hologram, how are you going to do that? But in fact, this is something that is current use in technology, and it isn't normally called a hologram, but it is a mask that is used for printing the patterns on a silicon circuit. So typically in a silicon circuit, you might want to print structures like this, but since we're printing sub-wavelength, it's very non-obvious what should the mask be. In fact, the mask, or the negative, if you want to call it that, is a complicated pattern. You can call it a holographic pattern. It's utterly non-intuitive. I would certainly challenge intuition to go from that design actually ends up as this exact integrated circuit pattern. And so I would think you'd have to agree the design is rather non-intuitive, but yet this is done by exactly the mathematical method that I described, which is with iterations, adjoint gradients, very, very sophisticated math. Now, you might say, oh, have you written a paper on this? Well, actually, you already have this in your cell phone. So the companies that make DRAMs with repeating units, or would make flash memory with repeating units, they put a tremendous emphasis on getting the optimal design of the mask, because even every small improvement goes straight to the to their bottom line profit. Those companies have actually bought the software from a company I started called Luminescent. Yes, this is the one. And so it is actually a commercial thing, but now we have a challenge, maybe even a greater challenge, to design the optimal two-dimensional hologram, which would split the solar spectrum. So I have here an example of what can be done. And this is there's essentially a hologram up on the left-hand side, and what we're trying to do is separate different colors. You can see the outcome is the red colors go this way, the green colors go this way, and the blue colors go this way. So this is very much in its infancy as an optimization problem, but let me show you what the iterations look like as you go through the iterations. So it starts out very, very messy with white light coming in, and finally, or very quickly, it converges on a structure where the colors are nicely separated. And you see it's pulsating because it's being optimized around an optimum, so it pulsates a little bit. And if you look at the figure of merit, this is how the figure of merit, which is essentially the coupling efficiency, how it grows with successive iterations. It improved very rapidly, and then it kept improving more slowly later on. And then you say, well, what does the hologram look like? So this is the pattern of the hologram. I think you'd have to agree it's rather non-intuitive, but as you go through the iterations, you end up... the math essentially ends up designing a hologram. And once we have optimized the hologram for splitting the solar spectrum, that's it forever because the sun isn't changing much, and so we're going to be dealing with what amounts to a solar splitter that can be used for generations to come. So that's the benefit of solving this mathematical problem. So this is just in its infancy, as I've indicated to you, but we're hoping for rapid progress as part of our center. So let me summarize. I emphasized the mathematical inverse design. And we do a one-time design of the holographic spectral splitter. We reproduce the hologram by stamping, and you saw examples of that in what John Rogers described. And then you can just stamp it out indefinitely just to get exactly the spectral splitting you want. Another editorial comment is we would like to have a nice upper band gap cell because we are going to tandems. They could be side by side, but we still need an upper band gap cell. We have a terrific gallium arsenide cell, which I showed you here, but for the upper band gap, what we're currently using is not high enough. It's gallium indium phosphide. We'd like to get an upper cell closer to 2.1 volts, an upper band gap cell. Another thing that has become clear, I hope, from the all-morning discussions is that we do know how to manipulate freestanding thin films. This is actually very revolutionary within electronics that we don't have to think about rigid wafers anymore. We can have thin films. We can stack them side by side. We can mix and match them and stack them one on top of the other. So I think that's become a standard part of technology. And if I could be so bold as to project into the future, we're looking, just to be in the game, you have to be talking 30 to 50% efficiency and at low cost, and that will be the norm to be expected. So I'm very optimistic. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
So one of the questions online is, why can't you just use a prism to split the light instead of these holographic films?
Well, a prism, that's a really good suggestion. A prism isn't bad, but let me go back and show you what some of the problems are with prisms. And so I'll go back to this slide. And so you see we had this issue that we had a certain surface area of the incoming sunlight, but we have a smaller area for the cells. Now, if you do a prism, where are you going to find room for the other cells? So suppose you have a prism and the light comes in and it refracts into different directions. Well, where are you going to find space once you start stacking them one next to the other? It becomes very prohibitive. So you end up with more complicated structures. They're deeper. You end up with bulk glass, which is undesirable. But you do have this kind of a problem, is you have one sun of white light, but then you have one sun of red light, one sun of yellow light, one sun of green light. Where are you going to put all those surface areas? Because there just isn't any room. And for this reason, if you're talking about a low profile structure that could be low in cost, and even 3 millimeters of glass, you might complain that you'd rather have the glass thinner. Even in this case, we have a little bit of glass, and we have a little bit of space, and we've dealt with the problem of crowding all the different colors together into the same area as the starting area. So I'm not opposed to prisms in principle, but you end up with some practical and cost difficulties. But it's maybe it's a sign of where things are headed. Definitely they're headed toward spectral splitters. Use the microphone, please.
So in your hologram simulations, do you consider the coherence length of the sunlight? There is some characteristic coherence length, like I think it's 125 microns.
Okay. This is a very clever and subtle question, pointing out that sunlight, even though it's coming from the sun, has some coherence. The length that you described, 125 microns, is actually lateral coherence, and it's represented by the size of the sun. So if the sun was a point source, the lateral coherence would be even wider than 125 microns. So in effect, we could take into account the solid angle subtended by the sun, but we have very little concentration here because we just needed to create space to separate the red, the orange, and the green light. So we're looking maybe at a concentration ratio of 5 or thereabouts. And at a concentration ratio of 5, we don't worry very much about the angle subtended by the sun. But that angle is what gives you your 125 microns.
So for the structure you optimize by using the inverse design method, is this the ultimate global optimum or it's a local optimum? Okay. Or we can always find some better solutions?
So the question is, when you try to find one of these holographic solutions, is it a global optimum or is it a local optimum and there might actually be a better one? There is a danger in this type of optimization that you will miss the global optimum. And you can do various things to try to guarantee that there's nothing better. You back it up with some analytical work that says how close you are to the theoretical optimum, because in the engineering world, you just know when to stop optimizing. If you can figure out when to stop optimizing, that's as good as getting a global optimum. So it is kind of an interesting question, and I think that it'll remain unanswered for a long time. Even in photonic crystals, we kind of think we know what is the optimum photonic crystal to create a band gap, but no one has ever proven that that's the global optimum. And so in this way, you can imagine that we could have this meeting 10 years from now. We would have solved the mathematical problem. We would have a pretty good holographic splitter. But somebody would raise their hand in the audience and say, I've got a better design because you haven't proven that you had a global optimum, so I can keep improving it. And you can imagine that people may keep trying to improve it for a very, very long time to come. So it's rather interesting. I can tell you that this it comes up very often in engineering. And engineering is just the solution is when it's good enough, then you stop. Okay, and you don't necessarily have to guarantee that it's a global optimum.
This program is brought to you by Caltech. Visit us at caltech.edu.